I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe composer Daniel Stephen Crafts. He will be in Santa Fe this coming weekend. It's part of Canticum Novum's spring offering, which is the ninth season concerts. And this Saturday and Sunday here in Santa Fe at the Cristo Rey Church, there will be a performance of a lot of pieces, including your piece, Daniel La Llorona. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be here, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you. Now, this is, of course, excerpts from La Llorona, because La Llorona is an opera in three acts, so they're not going to perform the whole thing. But you wrote this with Rudolfo Anaya writing the libretto. How did you come to do this project?
Well, actually, as it turns out, I had approached him on another subject. I was writing a vocal piece, an extended vocal piece, for the great tenor Jerry Hadley, who had spent a summer here and fell in love with the landscape of enchantment, of course, and suggested that we do a piece all about the American Southwest. And one of the writers that I knew from which I wanted to get a text was Rudolfo Anaya. So we met, and I told him something about myself, and he said, "Oh, you write operas." He said, "Well, you know, I have a play that I bet would make a great opera." And I said, "Well, by all means, please let me see it." Then he said, "Okay, I'll send it to you in the mail." So I got an envelope in the mail a couple days later, and I opened it up, and it said, "Time and place, Halloween night." I thought, "Oh, this is perfect. This is wonderful." Well, what it turned out to be was his play, The Season of La Llorona. And he takes the Hispanic legend of La Llorona, of which there are many, many, many versions, but he took his version of it and married it to the history of the conquest of the Aztecs by Captain Cortez and the woman Malinche, who was his translator and later his consort. And there's even a third tier to it, because the play and the opera opens in contemporary Albuquerque on Halloween night.
Nice.
And the little boy, Alfredo, is dressed in his Halloween costume, monster costume. Mama is baking bizcochitos in the kitchen, and suddenly there's a knock at the door. "Trick-or-treaters," says little Alfredo, and he runs to the door, but it's Abuelo, grandfather. Well, grandfather comes in, and he admires the little boy's costume, and he has a bizcochito, and then he says to Alfredo, "Well, you know, Halloween is a lot of fun for Americanos, but let me tell you a really gory story. Let me tell you about La Llorona." "Who's La Llorona, Grandpa? Who's La Llorona?" He says, "What? I never told you the story of Malinche, the beautiful Aztec princess who betrayed and was betrayed?" And then at this point, Abuelo, who is really Rudolfo Anaya, the storyteller, sings a little arioso that introduces the scene. And then magically, all of a sudden, we're transported back to the time of the Aztecs. And we're inside a beautiful Aztec temple with all of those wonderful designs and things like that on the wall. And then we meet Malinche and Captain Cortez. And it's now, this is about 10 years after the conquest of the Aztecs, and they've had a child together. And he's so about 8 years old, something like that. Well, the captain has been away for some time, and he comes back, and he sees the little boy all dressed as an Aztec and brandishing a spear, and he's disgusted with this. He says, "No more. I'm not bringing my son up to be a savage." He said, "I'm going to take him with me back to Spain and teach him how to be a proper Spanish nobleman." Well, now Malinche is feeling great guilt because she's betrayed her people once already. And the idea of her son being trained to be further oppressive of her people is just more than she can bear. And that's kind of where we begin the excerpts that we're doing on Saturday and Sunday.
And for those of you who are from New Mexico, you can guess the rest of the story. So this is great. So this is amazing. So you got this text in the mail, read it, said, "Oh my goodness, this is an incredible thing to make an opera out of."
Well, the character of La Llorona has, as I said, there are many, many versions of the legend, and it has been set to popular music many, many times. But I am so proud to say I got the first shot at creating this as an operatic character. And she's such an archetypal figure. I mean, in a way, it's much like Medea in killing her children.
Exactly. It's the same story in a lot of ways.
In many ways, it is. In many ways, it is. But it's, I mean, it's just the thing that opera cuts its teeth on. It's you know, all this incredible emotion. Because Malinche feels that... Now she ultimately kills the child, and you probably think, you know, a mother killing her child is probably the most heinous thing you can think of. But as the story unfolds, you realize that this poor woman is backed into a corner, and she's so conflicted by the whole situation that she feels there's really no way out. And the scene, one of the scenes that we do, the big aria for Malinche, is she goes into the temple and she summons the spirit of Moctezuma, the dead Aztec king, Moctezuma. And Moctezuma appears to her and he hands her an obsidian knife. And she thinks, oh, I'm to take my life. Well, I understand that. I understand that. That's all right. But then the little boy enters the temple and the ghost points to the little boy. And she's, oh my God, he wants me, the God wants me to kill my son. And it's a moment of incredible tension.
It was like Abraham and Isaac in the Bible.
Yes, very good. That's another good parallel.
Yeah. We're talking to composer Daniel Stephen Crafts. So, La Llorona, so you wrote the opera. Has it been performed as a whole yet?
Never as a whole. We've done excerpts of it several times in San Francisco. We did staged excerpts of it at the National Hispanic Cultural Center in 2008. And that was with a piano reduction, a piano and several instruments. This is the first time it's actually been done, any of it has been done with orchestra. So I'm very pleased with that. And Kenneth Knight, who directs Canticum Novum, is a wonderful, wonderful conductor. And I feel very, very secure in his hands.
Yeah, so you've got some terrific singers who are performing this piece.
The singers are absolutely wonderful. Well, Deborah Domansky just returned from a stint at the Metropolitan Opera. I mean, that's how good she is. I fell in love with her voice a number of years ago when she appeared in a starring role in the Santa Fe Opera's production of Radamisto. She sang the character Zenobia. And I was just entranced with her voice. It just blew me away. And then turns out she lives in Santa Fe. And she lives just around the corner from a friend of mine. And we've since become very good friends in the last couple of years. But she is my absolute choice to sing the role of Malinche. And I'm delighted that we have this first opportunity. I hope first of many.
One thing I admire about your work, and we talked with you last year about your production of the opera, or the first act of the opera that you wrote called Too Much Coffee Man, which was inspired by the comic book by the same name. But one thing I really admire is that you are working outside of academia, working outside of the sort of normal bureaucratic places, not that there's anything wrong with them necessarily, but where composers have the freedom to work. And from my perspective, it seems like that gives you the freedom to take on subjects that aren't normally taken on by contemporary composers.
Well, in a way, that's the whole idea of gonzo opera.
Define that.
Well, gonzo is definitely not what you're going to hear this weekend. This is an opera in the traditional sense. It's very dark. It's very, very emotional. But what I've been working in recently is what I've been come to call gonzo opera, which is real opera. It's not a parody or satire. I mean, using beautiful, beautiful operatic voices, but putting them in wild and crazy satirical comic situations that you would never expect to find in opera, such as Too Much Coffee Man. And the main character comes in dressed in that outrageous suit, and then begins to sing all about life, love, the universe, whatever. But
and the barista.
The barista is a wonderful character who knows there's more than just working as a coffee girl. That there's a whole world out there, and she's dying to explore it.
And you're writing another one now about the whole world of cell phones and devices and people not really talking to each other.
Yes, it's called Cellular World. And the libretto is by my dear friend Janice Lieber, who's a wonderful political satirist. She has a website called Chopped Liver. And by all means, go to it. It's always very, very funny. And this the Cellular World, which I just finished writing just last week, it opens up. On stage, you have two couples in bed on opposite sides of the stage with their backs to each other, and they're all texting somebody else about how lonely and miserable they are.
Exactly. There we have it. Well, and this is the thing. It's like if we watch a Mozart opera, we might get some themes which are still relevant today, but it's still out of another time, and these are the issues of our time, which they weren't writing about in the 19th century or the 18th.
You know, that's the thing. I was just talking to somebody that comedy really, the jokes go out of style so quickly. I mean, like in Shakespeare, there are wonderful, wonderful jokes, but they virtually all have to be explained to somebody. And
it's
how funny
true.
Can they be after they're, you know, after they have to be explained?
Well, I saw a compilation of the entire history of New Yorker cartoons. And so I went back to the beginning, and I didn't understand half of them.
Yeah.
Because they were relevant to some political situation or style thing of that time.
Topical reference
that
we don't really even know about, unless you're an expert in that particular period.
But then again, the wonderful thing about whether it be opera or theater, is that some of the themes and even some of the humor does carry over the ages.
Indeed, indeed.
And I would think the theme of alienation and technology isn't going away anytime soon.
Not anytime soon, that's for sure. It may transfigure itself into some other sorts of devices or inventions. Undoubtedly it will, but no, I think that concept of alienation is here with it.
You also have the distinction of writing melodies and music that is accessible to regular people who aren't necessarily into, let's say, 12-tone music or I mean, again, for the people who love that stuff, it's fantastic and it's all good. I'm not putting it down, but it's a lot of people, the reason they're listening to 18th and 19th century classical music is because it does seem to be more accessible.
It's melody. You know, the thing is, you can look at the whole history of what's called classical music from Gregorian chant up to, well, the middle of the 20th century anyway, and almost without exception, the classics are classics because they have great melodies, great memorable melodies. That's the thing.
Melodies and harmonies.
That's why people remember them. And so without that, you're losing one of the key elements of what makes music work.
Now, you have a great story about how when you were young, you got a wonderful offer to study at a music conservatory, but it didn't work out precisely because you wanted to write melody.
That's true. Well, at the time, and I give myself away at this point, in the late 60s, early 70s, when I was attempting to study composition officially, all anybody wanted to teach at that time was 12-tone theory or its many garden varieties or just the perpetually dissonant styles of music, which to me were not only aesthetically repugnant, but politically and philosophically reactionary, quite frankly. And I knew that was never going to work, but try to tell people that when, you know. When
so what did what happened?
Well, I just went off on my own. I say to people, when they ask me, who did you study with? I say, well, I studied with Mozart, Wagner, and Prokofiev. And they had a world of things to tell me just by looking at the scores, looking at all sorts of music, really, but studying the scores and seeing how and why music works.
Now, In your life, you've had a number of very fruitful collaborations, and we just talked about La Llorona and the collaboration with Rudolfo Anaya. You also worked very extensively with a wonderful tenor named Jerry Hadley, who unfortunately passed away several years ago.
He took his own life in a fit of horrible depression, which he suffered from. Well, I met Jerry in San Francisco, where I'm from, and actually, we got on really well because he was even more adamant against these dissonant styles of music than I was. And I didn't think that was possible. But he had lots of derogatory adjectives for that kind of music, which I won't even go into on the air. But anyway, we got on really, really well because he asked me to send him some of my music, and he called me back a few weeks later, and he said, "My God, you really do write melody." He said, "A lot of people say they do, but you really do write melody, and I would very much like you to write for me." And so that
was the beginning, and you recorded quite a lot with him.
Well, we recorded some. Unfortunately, when he passed away, we had a number of projects on the drawing board that never came to fruition. Actually, one of them is this, the tenor role in La Llorona of the Captain Cortez. And that was written for Jerry Hadley, but he never got the opportunity to sing it. Mm. So the tenor who's singing it here is a wonderful, wonderful young tenor by the name of Javier Gonzalez. And I first heard him with the New Mexico Philharmonic last year and thought he had a wonderful voice. And so I was delighted to recruit him to sing the role of Cortez. And him being Hispanic, of course, he loved the idea of playing Hernando Cortez.
Right, right. So Daniel Stephen Kraft is a composer, and excerpts from his opera La Llorona will be performed this weekend. It's part of Canticum Novum's spring concert of this year. And it's Saturday at 7 o'clock and then Sunday at 3 o'clock at Cristo Rey Church, which is on Canyon Road right here in Santa Fe. The wonderful Ken Knight is the artistic director and conductor. For more information, people can go to sfcanticumnovum.com. Now, we've got a little bit of time left. Would you like to play some music? Do you have anything from La Llorona, or should we hear something else?
Well, we don't have any really good recordings of La Llorona. That's one thing that I will get from this concert, is a really good recording with these wonderful singers and this wonderful orchestra and Kenneth Knight. There are some things. The recording, the one project that we did finish with Jerry Hadley was an extended vocal work called The Song and the Slogan, which is settings of poems by Carl Sandburg. And Sandburg was a very interesting character. He was a great advocate of working people's rights, and he would go around the country making political speeches. But to make the message go down a little easier, he would pepper his speeches with folk songs, singing folk songs. And that is the tradition out of which comes people like Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Burl Ives, even Bob Dylan later on. It all comes from Carl Sandburg.
Wow.
So when Jerry proposed to me that we set something of Carl Sandburg, I said, absolutely, I would be delighted to do that. And the result was this piece called The Song and the Slogan, which is taken from a line from one of the poems that we used.
So we will hear a little bit of that right now before we go. Daniel Stephen Kraft, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Ray Charlotte.
Thank you. nothing so much as one more sunrise or a sky. After the sunburn of the day, handling a pitchfork at a hay rack, after the eggs and biscuit and coffee, the pearl gray haystacks in the gloaming are cool.